Like a lot of people, I have a love-hate relationship with technology. I love what it does for us, but I hate what it does to us. I love that it could send a woman to the moon or map the fastest way to Kankakee, but I despise watching a room full of people staring, eyes wide and glassy, at a screen the size of a Pop-Tart. Too judgy? What can I say? I still remember when calculators were the size of dictionaries, and they were so sophisticated they could add, subtract, multiply, and divide. But the last laugh is on me. It's technology that's saving the day in the fight against COVID. And not just the things you've heard so much about, vaccine production and quick saliva tests. It's the supercomputers that do all the modeling, the programming that makes the Safer Illinois app, the nanotechnology that could potentially turn your phone into your own personal COVID testing site. It's head spinning. Today on Rising to the Challenge, we're talking technology and engineering in the U of I system. It's brainy, it's abstruse, I'm a rhetoric major, and even I think it's super cool. I'm going to break it all down for you, and you are going to love it. Stay with us.
The mystery virus started here in the city of Wuhan. Chinese authorities pinpointing its source to this food market. Those infected are being treated in medical centers, suffering symptoms similar to pneumonia.
We're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
I think Americans should be prepared that they're going to have to hunker down significantly more than we as a country are doing.
Right now, we turn to alarming numbers in the coronavirus pandemic. Those numbers have set records.
The rising number of cases and hospitalizations in many areas are still mounting.
Coronavirus cases continue to climb. Separately, the CDC says it's possible that the number of infections in the U.S. could be 10 times higher than the confirmed case count.
The governor has been preaching the importance of mask usage for months, but that message is gaining urgency as the number of cases across the state continues to rise because of what was described today as people's complacency.
This is a make or break moment for Illinois.
One of the most crucial cogs in the COVID mitigation plan at UIUC is the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. Who would have thunk that an animal lab would play such a starring role in keeping the positivity rate down? But it did, and I'm going to explain how. Tim Fan is a professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine, specializing in cancer in dogs and cats. He said there are only 22 veterinary diagnostic labs in the entire country. Last spring, part of the facility at UIUC was refitted to test human saliva samples. Lots of them.
Our diagnostic lab is by clear an outlier in the magnitude and scale of testing. And to give you a sense, you know, we started testing in July 6th, and we have almost 500,000 tests already run. In comparison to probably the next lab, animal diagnostic lab, that has been testing for much longer than we have, they may have 100,000 tests. It really is extremely promising that our strategies seems to be very effective, and, you know, success on this university with Shield should serve as an exemplar for how we can actually mitigate the spread of this virus across the nation.
Dr. Fan, whose family, by the way, has 7 dogs, 3 cats, 3 turtles, 2 snakes, a mantis shrimp, a bunny, a koi pond, and several aquaria, says that there were a few reasons that the vet lab was so easily converted into a lab for human diagnostics. 1, they already met the strict regulatory guidelines they needed, and 2, the lab already had an expert in coronaviruses in animals. Remember the story about the tiger at the Bronx Zoo getting COVID? This guy diagnosed it. And still other scientists already had experience setting up a COVID testing facility. It was like a perfect storm, in a good way. And now they are working 24/7, Monday through Friday, processing saliva samples.
So this is the designated COVID space. So we have 6 rooms on this end of the hallway that are dedicated to COVID testing. And so samples come through this door that we just walked through. This is one main receiving room in which samples are processed.
The designated COVID space was stacked high with scientific gear, computers, hoods, racks, bins, gloves, you name it. Inside every room were several exceptionally genial scientists in white coats who happily stopped what they were doing to explain the process to us. Catherine Best, research assistant professor in the bioengineering department and manager of the lab, was our escort.
Typically every day we get more than 10,000 samples. The samples are brought in here. They're labeled on the top. They're inspected, so we look for them. So we're looking for the quality of the sample and the amount of sample. Then we scan them in, and we heat inactivate them. So then they go into a water bath at 96 degrees for half an hour to heat inactivate the virus. After they come out of the water bath, now they're safe to be handled. So if the samples don't get processed here quickly, it's a trickle down and we all feel it. So
everyone knows their role in this scientific ballet. And like a busy hospital emergency room, there's a big whiteboard in the hall that's an at-a-glance indicator of the status of all the samples.
So we have it so that we can tell which samples are coming, either stat or batch or DIA. We mark when we've scanned them, when they've gone in the water bath, when they've been pipetted, when the master mix is on, when they're loaded into the Quant-7 instrument, and then when they're analyzed. If we have to do a retest, then we put the retests over here. So everybody in the process can see where we are at any given point in time.
Okay, can you decipher a couple of things for me?
Sure.
Batch is normal, stat is stat. What's DIA?
DIA, that's the Division of Intramural Athletics, I believe. So we are in the morning, we get about 190 samples, and this just ensures that the athletes on campus are able to practice together safely.
After the hot water bath, the next step is the additives the samples need. Catalysts called enzymes, buffers, primers, and probes that will help the virus copy itself millions of times until the computer can detect a positive or negative finding. These additives are called the master mix, which is made by hand and must be kept on ice. Then 5 microliters of master mix, which is the equivalent of 1/10 of a teardrop, is sucked into a pipette and combined with 5 microliters of saliva in tiny wells, all done by hand. Each plate of wells is maybe the size of a postcard. 4 of those are loaded into a computer the size of a mini fridge, and that eventually spits out the results. Here's Abigail Renbaum.
And how many? There are 380 in each?
Yeah, 384 samples in each plate.
So you can do 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, like 2,000 in an hour?
Roughly, yes, when we are, getting everything out and when we're really busy, for sure, definitely, yeah.
Aside from the computer analysis of the samples, I was shocked that everything was done by hand. For some reason, perhaps too many episodes of CSI, I just sort of assumed it was all automated. Catherine Best.
We do have robotics. We love robotics. However, I think humans are still faster and better at this moment in time.
There are a few robots in the labs and others being specially designed to be brought in to save man hours. But for now, every sample is still lovingly processed by hand until the results come in. But wait, that's not all. Meet Yvette Vlach, a positive hunter.
A positive hunter is somebody who has to go back through the samples that have already been processed, and if they have been called positive the first time, then basically you have to go back through the samples and pull the positives out of the racks and then put them in a separate rack and then retest them, essentially. So that's why we do it, just to make sure before we report out to someone that they have a positive result, that it is in fact positive. So that can that can keep us on our toes also.
Everyone seems like they are on their toes in this ballet. Finally, after the processing, testing, and retesting, the information gets relayed to the sample owner's cell phone and they go about their day. And the COVID conveyor belt keeps moving the samples through, over and over and over again.
My name is Rashid Bashir. I'm the Dean of the Granger College of Engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I'm also a professor of bioengineering.
I'm on a Zoom call with Dr. Bashir because of an article I read about nanotechnology. Now, at the time, I didn't really even know what nanotechnology was, other than what it implies. You know, technology that is really, really, really small. But then I read that Dr. Bashir and his team were developing a COVID test that employs the camera on your cell phone to read the result whenever and wherever you want. I was hooked.
So that's the idea of trying to bring the, you know, rather than taking the patient to the lab in all cases, if we can get the lab to the patient and do that by putting the lab on a chip, then there's some very, very interesting and impactful possibilities that can help humankind.
Bringing the lab to the patient requires everything in the lab, chemicals and processes and tests and medicines, to fit into very, very small spaces, like on a computer chip or cartridge. So it's a good thing computers that used to take up entire buildings now fit into the palm of your hand. That miniaturization is what made nanotechnology possible. Think the rapid glucose test available to people with diabetes, or the rapid pregnancy test on every drugstore shelf. Those over-the-counter tests were precursors to this new technology.
So we like to be able to go beyond, you know, the blood glucose testing or the pregnancy test and be able to test other diseases or conditions, other things beside just those two really good examples of successes for a point-of-care testing.
The test would look something like this. You take a swab from your nose or a bit of saliva, put it into a solution called a viral transport media, shake it up to loosen the particles, and add the solution to a cartridge the size of a credit card that has been preloaded with a special molecule. If COVID is present in the saliva sample, the special molecule binds to the COVID virus, and together in the cartridge, they start to phosphoresce or give off light.
And then this cartridge is placed into a little reader that's basically, let's say, half a shoebox size of half a shoebox. And it has the cell phone sort of attached to it or placed on it, where the cell phone camera can then detect the light emitted by the reaction.
Start to finish, the process would take 15 minutes or so. But it's not quite ready for prime time. They still have to figure out how to get the saliva into the cartridge without spills or contamination.
For any new approach now, we just have to figure out, you know, how we resource it, how we find the funds for the manufacturing challenges in this approach of this cartridge fabrication and the system design.
Then there are the regulatory challenges and problems in scaling the whole thing up. Nevertheless, Dr. Bashir is optimistic that the next steps can be taken within a year.
After the first prototype is sort of demonstrated, then I think it becomes a matter of how quickly we can bring in those expertise and resources to then really take it through manufacturing. We're also talking to potential commercial partners who we could get engaged with, who might be interested in helping us commercialize this.
Being on the cutting edge of biomedical research, his specialty is nanotechnology and cancer detection and infectious disease diagnostics, was not the most likely or predictable path for Rashid Bashir, who grew up in Pakistan and didn't come to the United States until he was 15. He may not have predicted this kind of career for himself, but his father did.
He came here when he was a naval officer in Pakistan Navy. He came here for training years ago, and he just kind of fell in love with all that America has to offer, you know, and what it stands for and what it stood for and what it stands for. So that's how that happened. We came here, and yeah, then just long story short, I could have never imagined that I would be where I am today.
Today, he is not only the Dean of Engineering and a professor of bioengineering, he also holds a distinguished chair. He also has authored or co-authored over 250 journal papers, over 200 conference papers and conference abstracts, and over 100 invited talks. He also has been granted 45 patents. Just to give you a flavor, some of his randomly selected paper titles include DNA-mediated fluctuations in ionic current through silicon oxide nanopore channels, and dielectrophoretic separation and manipulation of live and heat-treated cells of listeria on microfabricated devices with interdigitated electrodes. He is an accomplished guy, and he is just as warm and friendly as he is talented. But interestingly, it wasn't until late in his training, and he had a lot of training, that he thought about engineering as it applied to medicine.
Actually, in the last semester of my PhD is when I took some courses in bioengineering. And I just got really excited and turned on with sort of cardiovascular systems and nervous systems and how complicated and how intricate and how beautiful biology is and how much is still yet to be discovered and learned. And how much of engineering is actually mimicking biology. We're trying to mimic the auditory system. We're trying to mimic the brain, the visual system. And in some cases, we are very far from it. We can build a supercomputer to do these amazing things, but we still cannot replicate in close to even the complexity of what a human brain can do, right? Which is the size of an apple and runs on sugar.
Nanotechnology has already given us at-home drug tests, at-home monitoring systems, and watches that tell us how well we slept, just to name a few. But what about a smart toilet that can detect a urinary tract infection, pregnancy, or colon cancer? It won't be long before we see a lot more of this kind of technology, according to Dr. Bashir.
I do believe absolutely that in, you know, some years to come, maybe 20 years or even earlier, I think we would have many of these devices around us which can be measuring, you know, the state of your health, whether it is breath analysis, whether it is body fluids that are excreted, or whether it is fluids that you take out, right? There is also sensors and devices now that are, you know, wearables. So I think these fields are moving very fast, and it's a very exciting, you know, developments are taking place.
Rashid Bashir, Dean of the Granger College of Engineering at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Institute for Genomic Biology is a contemporary building in the middle of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. In the front sit three modern sculptures. One is bright orangey-red, one is chartreuse, and one is yellow. They look like someone has taken out their day's frustrations on giant globs of Play-Doh. In fact, they were originally called the Blobs by the artist, but now they're called a much more dignified Darwin's Playground. My producer, Libby Foster, and I came to IGB to meet Nigel Goldenfeld, professor of physics and leader of the biocomplexity group at the Institute. We found a quiet space in a conference room, but between the masks and the social distancing, it was a little challenging.
Yeah, you might have to talk a little louder if you can.
I'm British, so it's hard to do.
We wanted to talk to him because he's one of the architects of the University of Illinois COVID response. He and his team did all of the modeling that laid out the do's and don'ts for both the University of Illinois and the state of Illinois. Here he is in late April, speaking at one of Governor Pritzker's press conferences.
By heeding the governor's stay-at-home order, The population of Illinois has dramatically altered the trajectory of the epidemic in ways that we had hoped for but could not precisely predict. The epidemic is like a rocket that you can move by mind control. It's not rocket science. It's harder.
Based on the data they collected and some math wizardry, they were able to predict how many times to test people, how many people would likely comply with mask wearing and social distancing, how to get results faster for the high-risk folks, etc. And, as it turns out, modeling may be complicated, but it's nothing new.
The equations that describe epidemics had been written down by mathematical epidemiologists nearly 100 years ago. And they're relatively simple extensions of what people do in mathematical ecology. So what these models typically do is they say, let's follow the progression of people with various stages of the disease. So somebody might be just completely uninfected, just a susceptible person who could get infected. Or there could be somebody who has been infected and is now infecting other people. There could be people who've died. And so then you'd make a model that sort of roughly says, what is the probability that if you're in one of these categories, you then transition to the next category.
And the modeling that he and his team did enabled the university to reopen this fall when many others couldn't. I figured these supercomputers would be the size of, say, the Pentagon. But Goldenfeld assured me it's just a garden variety supercomputer you could get off the shelves at Walmart. When August rolled around and the students came back, everything went smoothly. Almost. There was an unexpected bump in the number of cases at the end of August, well over what the models predicted. They took a lot of razzing. The culprit? Students who tested positive, but partied anyway.
We famously got lampooned in the geek comic XKCD, so that was very funny. But the more serious point is this, that non-compliance is not just something restricted to students. We see it, for example, in Washington, D.C. today, where people are not social distancing, not wearing masks, not following, not doing contact tracing, not following recommendations to self-quarantine if they've been exposed or potentially been exposed. So we see that happening right in front of our eyes.
Because of their modeling, the university was able to identify and contain the outbreaks at the end of August and beat the infection back to, on the day we spoke to Dr. Goldenfeld in early October, 0.3%. Since then, it's dropped to less than half that.
Yesterday, I think we had 7 cases that came up on campus.
But this kind of modeling is not just as simple as plugging in numbers.
With epidemiology, you actually have to worry about how people are going to behave once they hear the prediction. So if they, for example, know that, oh dear, there's a prediction is the epidemic is going to get a lot worse, well, then everybody will go and hunker down in their basement, socially distanced like crazy, and the epidemic won't get worse. And then they'll say, hey, you told us it was going to be a terrible epidemic. It was nothing. So then they will go out and, have a good time and take less care. And then, of course, then the numbers will start to rise. And so human behavior will change the predictions as a result of the predictions themselves existing.
As if it wasn't complicated enough. But physicists are multi-talented. If you're a physicist, mathematician, sleuth, this is the job for you.
People sometimes say, physicists, you should stay in your lane. Just work on your black holes or your quantum mechanics or something. But the style of physics that we have is a style which proudly has no lane.
Physicists are very interdisciplinary. So interdisciplinary, in fact, that Nigel Goldenfeld is moving on to data analytics. Since the school has completed more than 500,000 COVID tests, you can imagine how much data there is to keep straight. But still, with all his experience as a modeler, I had to ask if he could model something about the future of the pandemic.
If you're asking, are we near the end of COVID? I would say no. Even if there's a vaccine was developed tomorrow that worked and was safe, it would take a long time before it was generally available. We don't even know how well it would work, how long it would work for. So I think the sort of measures that we're doing right now are going to be with us for some time.
Now all he has to worry about is what's going to happen when the weather turns cold, people go inside, the flu season gets going, and 2021 comes barreling through.
Okay, the beginning of the leg has started.
It's sort of weird to think that I've had actual COVID virus in the back of my car multiple times.
A lot of it.
Yes. Okay, so I just take a look at the numbers, so 78, because I like to keep track of how many samples I'm transporting. Okay.
Brian Reeves is a creature of habit.
I've recorded every single trip, just so I can keep track of statistics. I'm sort of anal retentive that way.
Every Monday through Thursday for months, he has done the exact same thing at the exact same time in the exact same way.
So we are transporting 366 COVID samples today.
At 4 o'clock exactly, he shows up to drive the COVID saliva samples from the University of Illinois in Springfield to the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champain, a 90-mile trip one way. But then, of course, with empty trays in hand, he has to drive back.
It's going to be a 180-mile round trip. And this is exciting. My starting mileage today is 199,942 miles. So at some point, my car will turn over to 200,000 miles. This is a 16-and-a-half-year-old Toyota Prius that has served me well.
Okay, so since you're a stats guy, how many miles have you put on your car?
Well, so far doing the COVID runs, I have done 4,513 miles. And so at the end of this round trip, it'll be 4,693 miles. So sometime next week, I will clear 5,000 miles.
He's living in his own COVID version of Groundhog Day. And I am riding shotgun.
Yeah, so actually the first thing we're going to do is we're going to stop at the gas station here before we get on the interstate so I can get my Coca-Cola, get my caffeine going.
Each day, it's the same gas station.
Now you'll notice I'm passing up this gas station, which would be easier to stop at, because I've noticed they don't wear their masks inside and they let customers in without masks. We don't like this gas station. We go to the next one.
To get the same extra large Coke.
Okay, I'm just going to say I'm not only impressed with the size of that drink, extra large, I'm also thereby impressed with the size of your bladder.
Today, something out of the ordinary happened. The cashier waved him through the line and said that the Coke was free.
It may be that she sees me in there every day at this time buying a soda. Maybe this is my...
She feels so sorry for you.
This is my buy 20, get one free.
After that unpredictable pit stop in an ocean of predictability, we got back in the car and out onto the open road. And when I say open, I mean open. Not a hill, not a dale. The tallest thing for miles is the golden arches of the many McDonald's along the route, one of which will be our dinner spot.
This seems like a silly question because I think I know the answer, having known you as long as I have. Do you always get the exact same meal at McDonald's?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a foodie. All through middle school and high school, I had the exact same lunch every day.
What was it?
Peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And you know what? I cannot stand peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to this day. But I was fine with it. I will eat the same thing over and over and over and over. And then one day I'll just be like, nope, I'm done.
Told you he was a creature of habit. Last March, when the university system sent kids home and went online due to COVID, Brian Reeves didn't have much to do. He is the director of the University of Illinois Springfield's Sangamon Auditorium, which had just gone dark. No performances, no crews, no scheduling, no audiences, no planning. So he called the administration and said, I'm free if you need help. A few weeks later, he started driving endlessly.
To me, this is something that's really needed. I mean, there is obviously a healthcare crisis going on right now. And if me sitting in the car for 3 hours a day helps out, I'm glad to do it. I don't have any family in town. I don't have kids. I'm not dealing with schooling issues or childcare issues. And, you know, I'm not a nurse. I'm not a doctor, but I can drive spit. So that's what I do.
We were maybe 20 minutes into our 90-minute drive when Brian pulled out a Tupperware container full of homemade-looking cookies.
Here, this is the point where I would open up that tub of cookies and try a cookie. So
if let me help you out here.
Why don't we try one of these cookies?
I want to say for the people who cannot see them, they look delicious.
These are chocolate chip cookies, but they're made with discarded sourdough starter. Because I've been, you know, doing a lot of baking during the COVID shutdown. And these are delicious. They are very cake-like. So I'd love you to try one and tell me what you think.
I will. I can definitely taste the sourdough.
He may not think he's good, but he is thoughtful. He named his sourdough starter Bubba and feeds him every day. Food is a big part of this trip.
Since the COVID shutdown started, I think I've gained easily about 15 pounds. So, you know, doing the McDonald's meals on the road, that doesn't help. But it's kind of like just eating in the car is something else that it makes the time go by. Otherwise, it's 3 hours of just staring at the road.
And there is a lot of just staring at the road. On the day I drove with him in early October, it was Brian's 26th trip. That's 78 hours, so far, of staring at the flatlands of Illinois. Now me, I'm a born and bred flatlander, so I'm kind of used to the whole soul-crushing landscape of the Midwest. But surprisingly, Brian isn't.
I've been to over 45 countries. I've visited 48 of the 50 states. I would say being on tour with theatrical shows and being on the bus and every day making these long hauls, I've seen it all. Mountain driving, oceanside driving, you know, Midwest driving. And this is probably the second most boring drive.
Hard to believe there's a drive more boring than this one.
The first most boring drive is when you really get out there into Utah and Nebraska, Utah, South Dakota. Oh my gosh, you know, kill me now.
45 minutes in, it's time to eat again at the aforementioned McDonald's. These are the things that pass for entertainment when driving from Springfield, Illinois to Champaign, Illinois.
Are you ready?
Hi, could I get the quarter pounder with cheese, no onions, extra pickles, and the medium French fry, please?
Anything else for you?
Yes, and can I get a medium...
Diet Coke.
Medium Diet Coke. That's great. It'd be part of the meal.
Yeah. Oh, perfect.
But wait, I may have spoken too soon.
So very shortly, my baby is going to be 200,000 miles old. Let's see here. It's getting close. I'm so excited. Here we go. Standing by. Here it comes. So close. Almost. There it is, 200,000 miles on the Toyota Prius.
Despite running a performing arts center, Brian Reeves doesn't like the limelight.
And like in high school, everybody in high school, of course, wanted to be the lead actor or actress and be out on stage. And no, I wanted to be, you know, backstage, or I wanted to be in the control booth. And I was just amazed at all the switches to bring the lights up and down. I just wanted to be by myself. And when everybody after the show would go out into the lobby to greet family and friends, I was just content to grab a broom and start sweeping the stage.
Which is kind of like the job he's doing now, carting the samples from one campus to another campus. It's unsung and largely unheard of.
And here we are in Champaign.
About to cross into Champaign proper.
Yes, so we're off the interstate now. We've actually come to a red light. So this is another milestone. Now I know it's this red light, the next red light, then we're going to see three more red lights. We're going to turn left, and then we're going to get on the campus. Here we are. We're parking. And now we're going to get the samples out.
And with that, our 90-mile adventure came to a close.
Okay, this is where I try to be manly and do this all in one trip as I stack up these four containers.
With the saliva samples safely in the lab in Champaign, Brian wastes no time in getting new, empty trays back in the car for the return trip. Soon, he'll only be making one trip a week as other drivers step up to the plate and a diagnostic lab opens on the Springfield campus. But even without 26 trips to Champaign, Reeves has plenty to keep him busy. The University of Illinois Springfield Sangamon Auditorium Performing Arts Center is waking from its hibernation and opening to performances streamed to audiences online. There's baking to be done, and there's always Bubba, the sourdough starter, to feed. Rising to the Challenge was produced and engineered by Libby Foster, with editing help from Shayna Roth. Special thanks to Tim Colleen, Moss Bresnahan, Lily Duncanson, Laura Clower, Robin Kaler, Kirsten Ruby, David Mercer, Gretchen Yorty, and Tom Hardy. Rising to the Challenge is a production of the University of Illinois System, with production support from Illinois Public Media. I'm Gwen Maxey. Thanks for listening.